This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. God, family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got it. Wildlife Control Supplies, proven solutions for wildlife control, delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're in the ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company, have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you. Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it, fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light, sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dead camp. Shotgun toter, Republican voter. Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA. Cause this is what I say.
Welcome to Trapping Across America. This is your host, Clint Locklear, and we're going to be covering some different topics, not as many as normal today, but because one of them is quite large, and it seems really simple, but there's a lot of lessons and things to take into account. We're going to talk about different ways of securing a trap, chain, wire, extension cables, about those chains, about the swivels, about the rivets, about all that type stuff. And it's a time of year, if you need to get your gear in line, guys, this is the time to do it. Come next November, not the time. This is a good time to do it. But before I do, I want to do a shout out to the scientist and Al Gore and all the people, I don't know if you know this or not, but Al Gore and even the Obama administration has basically came out and said, if you're a global warming denier, that you need to be punished. Now, I'm an environmentalist, and I'm going to let that sit with you a second, because I am an environmentalist, and if that gets you upset with me saying that, we're probably, when we do a show on dichotomy, how that affects you and your trapping and your regular life, you may look at that a little bit different at that point, but I am an environmentalist. I don't want someone come in here and dump toxic chemicals in my yard. I don't want somebody to come in here and do something that's going to screw up my wells, the water table on my wells. I don't want, you know, crazy stuff like that. I'd like to live in a clean place with good water and good sunshine and good air like anybody else. So in that point right there, I am an environmentalist, no doubt whatsoever. Environmentalism, the way that it is portrayed today, is almost to the point of being kooky. It's like a bunch of fairy dust stuff. And when you hear global warming, all that is a taxing scheme that is being very well marketed to the very uninitiated. And a lot of these people are falling victim of just, you know, perception marketing that they don't think for themselves, or they don't do whatever. Now, as most of you know, I do a lot of gardening, and I got a lot of fruit trees, and it's April. Every now and then we will get a light frost somewhere around the 1st of April, something like that. We've been in the 50s and 60s probably pretty much for, now don't get mad if you're up north somewhere and you're still freezing in the morning, but 50s and 60s, it's definitely springtime here. And for the last 2 years, we've been getting frost. Our hard frost are coming later and later. So the thing that I want to say to Al Gore and all of Obama's cronies and all these scientists that do studies because they're paid by an administration that's working on marketing information, they can kiss my lily white butt on global warming. Because I can tell you right now, I wish we had some global warming. It is getting harder and harder with all this global warming and raising temperatures and stuff like that to grow fruit trees and different things like that through millennium. I've had no problem with whatsoever, and people have had very little problem with where things work just the way they want to. The same day that we got 25 degrees, after it's been 60 degrees here, my buddy Chip down in Mississippi sent me a text. It was snowing in Mississippi, and he's not in northern Mississippi neither. Snowing in Mississippi. He just planted some figs and persimmon and stuff like that, and I'm sure his fig trees, just like mine, went into epileptic shock over all this global warming and nonsensical marketing that we're hearing day in and day out. It drives me insane when I hear that stuff, because I'll be honest with you, and here's where critical thinking comes in, guys. We're not going to talk about the environment. Critical thinking is if you use it, you can tear apart these arguments really, really quick. The basic one is, over the next 1,000 years, we're going to raise a degree. Good. If that was true, good. Farmers would probably have an extra 2 weeks before and 2 weeks after to grow more crops. We're not getting a smaller population in the world, we're getting a bigger one. That's probably going to be pretty much needed. If that was the case, I wouldn't have to worry about frost every year the way I've been worrying about it the last 5 or 6 years, where it's been getting worse and worse and worse as far as cooler, longer. Even in the springtime and the summer down here, we're almost getting temperatures until they spike here and there, almost like someone that lives in New Hampshire or Northern Ohio or something like that. As far as the South being hot, smoking hot, it ain't been that way in several years in the summer. We get a little bit of it in August and September. But if you use common sense when you're thinking about this or trapping or any other argument, someone, break down what they're saying. Because it'll make a huge difference of your quality of thinking and your quality of life, because you won't fall victim to these crazy things. And I'm gonna get on the trap, but before I do, I want you to think about something. There's a story that if you ever go to motivational speakers or listen to them, there's a very common story that a lot of people tell, that people get all warm and fuzzy and all this type stuff on, that could be with anything. It could be something on trapping, it could be something on the environment, it could be something on business, it could be something on family life, it could be whatever. There's a kid walking on the beach, and a stranger's watching him from a sand dune. And he's watching the kid run up and down the beach because there's a fish die off and the fish are washing up on the shore. And they come up and the kid is frantically throwing the fish back in the water so they can survive. And the older guy comes off the sand dune and says, "Son, what are you doing?" And he goes, "Well, I'm saving these fish." And the older man looks around up and down and he goes, "Well, there's no way you can save all these fish. It's not going to matter." And the kid, you know, being all starry-eyed and all this, he looks up at the older man and said, "Well, to this fish, it matters." And motivational speakers use that over and over again in different formats, but it's always the same thing. Little bitty incremental things that you can do matters. But from a critical thinking point of view, and I've heard this story several times, and I was listening to Jack Spirico on the Survival Podcast, and he brought up how foolish that is. The fish are washing up because there's lack of oxygen, or it's their time to die, or there's an algae bloom, or something's going on that's killing the fish. The fish aren't lost. The fish aren't trying to get up there and get a suntan. The fish are dying because the fish are dying. You can throw all the fish you want back in there to make yourself feel good about it, but the fish are still going to die because they were dying before you got there and started throwing them back in. So the warm, fuzzy feeling of a story like that has nothing to do with reality. Just like the global warming, or when you're talking to someone that's an animal rights activist, if they automatically go into arguing with you instantly and start getting aggressive with you, you're wasting your time, because you're talking to somebody that does not understand critical thinking and has not thought anything through to the point of anything. People have the craziest ideas. There's a guy on YouTube that has 800 or 700 ducks. And he's figured out a way to train the ducks that they come up to the chopping block to get their last little snack. And they have a great life for 2 or 3 years, and then they have one bad second, literally a second. Their head's gone. The ducks are in line behind them. There's no stress to the duck that got killed whatsoever to be harvested for meat. None whatsoever. He moves those ducks to the side. The next duck saw the other duck get killed. He waddles up there, puts his head on the chopping block, And it repeats for like 600 times, and there's no stress whatsoever in the ducks. There's no pain in the ducks. It's the most ingenious way to harvest ducks I've ever seen. I don't know if it'll work on chickens, but I'm going to try it. He gives them a great life, better than they have in the wild, better than they are definitely going to have in some type of confinement thing in a factory farm somewhere. They have a great big lake. They do this. He feeds them well. They're trained to do all kind of stuff. You can tell they're just happy ducks. And at the end of their life, all they have is one bad second. And people will get irate that you harvest a duck or a chicken. To them, it's just so brutal that someone would kill an animal, you know, and they ain't even crapped out their chicken McNuggets or their chicken salad from somewhere yet. When they say that, just because they don't think, or they've never been exposed to it, or they think it's just, I don't know, like Friday the 13th when you harvest an animal, they cannot comprehend, because they don't use critical thinking about that. All the animals, the tens of thousands that have died so they could live, does not come into equation when they think about or talk about how to deal with animals. So you got to think about critical thinking. When you're hearing someone say something, don't just do the automatic response. An automatic response is, if you don't vote, you can't bitch. Moronic statement, 100%. If you're taking my money and giving me regulations and control of my life, I can bitch. But people automatically go to that without thinking about it, and it's moronic. It absolutely is moronic. But people believe stuff like that, and people also believe stuff like that in the trapping. Just automatic stuff that's been said so many times that it's become a truth that is not truth on the trap line, but it's truth to trappers because you don't critically think. Guys, you've got to critically think and question everybody and everything, including me, definitely me. You've got to question everything. But when you start questioning, you start asking the right questions. And that's when life becomes a lot more interesting when it comes to trapping. It's because of when you start asking the right questions, you start coming to a lot better answers instead of belief. What's the best trap for to catch a coyote? Well, what's the knee-jerk response? But is there really a lot of thought process into that? What's the best set to catch a fox? What's the best trap? What's the best this? What's the best that? Instead of saying, you know, a dirt hole is the best way to catch a fox, if you start critically breaking that down from the point, and if you disagree with somebody, you know, and they start getting aggravated because you start questioning, just back off. You're not going to go anywhere with it, but it's something you need to be mature enough in your own life to be able to ask these type questions. Is the dirt hole the best set? Is it the best way to handle weather? Is it the best way to control the animal? Is it the best way for your efficiency, for your input and output of your results? When you start asking these type things, it gets pretty interesting because then you start really questioning, you start digging. And then when you start digging, that's when you really find the gold, the little gold nuggets everywhere. And that's what makes trapping to me so interesting. Makes life interesting too. Because you catch yourself, and I do the same thing. You say things that you've been trained to say over and over and over again to the point you don't even think about it when you say them. Just like if you don't vote, you can't bitch. Well, it's ignorant. If you harvest your own animals, you're being cruel. As the person is like the mafia, you know, kingpin has hired people to do the killing for him forever and thinks he's better than the person that actually pulls the trigger. It just doesn't make any sense. So when you're thinking about your trapping, always think about, is this a knee-jerk response that I've just heard over and over again and you automatically say it? You know, is 4 pounds really the best for a coyote? Maybe the question would be, do I need pan tension to catch a coyote? Maybe the person that's doing that has got different reasons from you why you should be using 4 pounds. You got to start digging. You got to start looking around in there and figuring these things out for yourself. Now, one of the biggest things on critical thinking that really bogs down a lot of trappers that I've gave instruction to is a basic principle that goes all through business, all through life, all through trapping, all through fishing, all through hunting. It pretty much goes through everything, including someone's hobbies, to their profession, to everything. And it's called the 80-20 rule. And a lot of people know about the 80-20 rule, but the 80-20 rule can be frustrating to follow a lot of times. And the 80-20 rule, if you have a business, let's say you're going to get in the trap supply business. And okay, so you're going to be in the trap supply business, so you got to have traps, and you got to have sifters, and you got to have dye, and you got to have lure, and you got to have DVDs, and you got to have, you can go on and on. Just go find a catalog, read all the way down through there. That's what you got to have to be a big time supply dealer. The smarter guy, in my opinion, this is my opinion, the smarter guy that follows the 80-20 rule is going to have a better business than someone that does not follow the 80-20 rule. And this is where critical thinking comes into something as simple as a supply business for trappers. Or a fur buyer that's buying fur locally. Or anything, it doesn't matter what it is. It could be fishing. It could be deer hunting. It could be anything. It could be gardening. It could be building four-wheel drive trucks. It could be anything you want it to come to. 80-20 rule is very consistent all the way across the board. And when you really study people that are highly efficient in what they do, they really follow this 80-20 rule. And most of the time, if you read enough of their stuff, somewhere in there, the epiphany of the 80-20 rule comes out. And that's when everything starts clicking for them. So if you're a supply business guy and you've got $100,000 to go into inventory, which would be a small, very small supply business, but you need inventory because you got to have something to sell. In the days of you know, running credit, people giving you stuff for free and all this other type nonsense that worked back in the 90s, that's kind of going around. So pretty much if you're going to get in it today, you're going to have to pony up the money to begin with. So you've got, say, $100,000. So you've got to split that $100,000 between all these different things that you want to buy, which means you're not going to have enough money to buy any volume of anything. It also means you're going to have a bunch of different parts in there that have different profit margins and different what's in style at the moment of what people are buying. So you're going to have $100,000 in that inventory. And if you run the numbers, not what you think you should do, not what people tell you you should do, not what you feel warm and fuzzy about doing, but if you run the numbers on a business after, say, 3 years, because the startup, it's not going to really tell you anything because no one knows who you are and you haven't really figured out how to market yourself yet, and you're just kind of, you know, limping along trying to get sales here and there. But after 3 years, or when you start getting some decent sales, if you put everything on that spreadsheet, and trust me, guys, this has a lot to do with trapping. Just follow the example out with me. And you put the money that you put in traps, the money that you put in snares, lures, DVDs, sifters, hammers, trap dye, waders, rain jackets, whatever it is that you've got, you put all those in there. What you cost, what it cost you, what you sold it for, what your profit margin is, what the shipping differences is between the two because size and weight and yada yada, and you get all that straightened down. What you're going to find out is in almost every business, there's going to be a core of that business that 20% of that business drives almost all of the sales. So 20% of something in that business, whatever that may be, is going to be where all the money comes from pretty much. And 80% is only going to get you about 20% of that number. But you've got all that time, energy, money, everything in that 80%, and most of it energy, to only get a small return. Well, that one core thing is what's really doing on your business. Now, successful business people concentrate on the 20, and they let the 80% fall by the wayside. They may piddle with it just a little bit, just to keep some interest up, maybe do some specials, maybe do this, that, and the other, loss leaders, whatever you want to do, but they concentrate on that 20%. And the issue when a trap supply business is, they think they've got to have everything for everybody and have everything for every customer and this, that, and the other. So they spread everything out and they're doing 80% of the work with 80% of their money and 80% of the energy for very little return, and they wear themselves out when they have a few things that are 20% part of their core, which they should be concentrating on. And if you concentrate on that, now you can really grow a business. Now, what does that have to do with trapping? Guys, it has everything to do with trapping. The 80-20 rule definitely is for trapping. And here's why. We're going to use coon trapping for an example, or mink trapping. Mink trapping is even an easier example. You're going to go out and you're going to run so much line, so we're going to say that's 100%. If you were to track and be honest with yourself and take all of the reasons and the wants and the warm fuzzies and all this out of the equation, you're going to have 20% of your locations going to catch you most of the mink. It's going to be a certain style location in your area, whether it be a bridge abutment or roots or bottom edge set or something like that, that 20% of those locations is going to catch you
80% of your animals. And then this particular set is also going to fall. And it's amazing how these numbers work. You have 20% that's also going to be a certain style of set that's going to give you 80% of your catch. But what do most trappers do? They burn most of their energy over the whole entire thing. So let's just, for an example, say you're a bottom edge set guy and you go run 100 traps and you're running majority of, or you're splitting all your sets up between bottom edge, the suicide sets on the bridge wall, you're raising traps in high water next to bridge walls, you're putting dry land trails in, you're putting pockets in, you're putting dry land pockets in, you're doing blind sets up next to rocks, and you're putting blind sets down roots. If you put all this on a spreadsheet, what you're going to find out is one of those sets is going to catch you 80% of your mink. One of those sets. And then you can break that down further, and this type of location also catches me 80% of those mink. But what do trappers do when they go out and they see a creek? They spend all that energy, all that time, all that equipment, most of the time setting 80% of their line for 20% of their catch. And they wonder why it's stagnant. And I'm not saying don't be creative about what you're doing by any means. Anybody that knows me very long, I love creativity. I love trying to figure out different ways to do things. But you don't do that as the whole block, not if you're interested in keeping your catch up. You know, I've done a lot of things, especially the last 3 or 4 years. Some of them worked really well. Some of them were bombs. I mean, they just sucked. Where I spend a lot of energy thinking something's going to work and it doesn't. Now, I could mix in some other stuff and have some catches, but if I keep using all that energy on a system or location that's not working the way I thought it was, your catch is always going to be down. But if you're running a mink line and you're setting all these particular sets up because it makes you a more advanced, quote, trapper, or a more rounded trapper, or I could catch one there. I mean, I did catch a mink in that set a couple of years ago, and it looks kind of similar, so I'm going to go do this over here again. If you don't follow that 80-20 rule, You're always going to be pushing yourself through your own actions down further and further. It's almost like a race to the bottom of 20%. Well, I'd much rather be racing upwards towards the 80%. Because if you've got 100 mink that come through a line and you catch 20, well, that's pretty good. But if you got 100 mink that come through the line and you catch 80, that's really good. And you can pull that off year in and year out, because you really narrow down what you're doing on the best locations and the best set and different things like that, you're going to be, I mean, rocking and rolling in mink trapping. Well, the same thing can be said for coon trapping, coyote trapping, fox trapping, cat. That's the reason when people get kind of frustrated, because like at conventions, I've been trapping cats hard for 15 years. And I've done about every type set and location and combination of blocking and lures and this, that, and the other that I could possibly come up with. And I'm sure I'm not through on that. But by really concentrating on the cats, because that's always been one of the ones that's turned me on, kind of like otter, if I was really honest with myself. Because, guys, let's just admit it. When you go out and you're in a certain area and the ground set a certain way and the brush and the logs and the rocks and this, that, and the other, it's fun to go into kid mode, which is great, and just try a bunch of crap out. But what happens if you do that with no consistency or no game plan, every set you've got is haphazard. And haphazard is just chaos. And your catch is chaos because of that. Because if something in there is working, how in the world do you know? I mean, you really don't. You know, did he get here because of this or that or the flag or the blocking or the length on the hole or whatever, you don't know. But over those 15 years, I mean, of really targeting cats, the two ways that's my 20% to catch 80% of the cats is two ways. I've kept meticulous notes. I played around with these in different methods, and when I start getting out of that high catch ratio, I pull back into what it is, because I want to catch a lot of cats. When I show the system that I use on cats in my Cat Collector DVD, and it's the same set over and over again, that's because that is the gives me 80% of my cat catch. And when I get out of those rules of that system, the cat catch starts dropping off dramatically. So I bring it back. So what I've learned is I can change that set up a little bit, but it's got certain rules. You know, the trap's so far back from the hole. The blocking is a certain way to control the cat. The edge of the pan is set in a certain direction. The flagging is in a particular place. The eye peel at the back of the set is at the particular place. The lure is at a certain distance from the traps. All those keep me in that 80% mark. When I start screwing with those, if my catch don't go up, I pull back into what I was doing. And I try new stuff all the time, but I let the animals tell me. If I'm getting out of the high percentage, then I pull back to what I'm doing. And you see this all the time with all different kind of systems for that. The other way that I've learned for cats, especially in the East, and even in lots of the more Midwest, on those coon trails, and especially the lighter coon trails, a little bit farther away from the water, snares are freaking deadly on bobcats. So when I'm trying to catch the highest amount of cats in the shortest amount of time with the least amount of energy, 80% of my energy goes into those two things. Now, if I went out and I was just putting in generic dirt holes and wire cubbies and box cubbies and rock cubbies and hanging baits and walkthroughs and exposed traps and this, that, and the other, I mean, I can go, you can just sit there and name bobcat sets all day long. And if you follow a lot of people, they use all of them. But there's only a few of them that's bringing in the money. There's only a few of those locations, styles of locations, that are bringing in the money. And they're going to be different no matter where you go. You learn different things. If you hammer a place in Texas year after year after year, like it's been done with us, sooner or later, and it usually takes about 3 years, the bigger show or your flags start losing interest. The survivors have figured out that that's not a good thing to go to. So you got to start toning that down. Well, now, because of seeing the pattern and trying to keep in that percentage, I've learned when I go in somewhere, big, showy, flashy, I want it to look like Vegas for a bobcat, great. If I keep doing that for so many years, I got to start toning that down or my catch drops. Now, but if I were to keep up with that big flag, I'm going to start going to where I'm spending 80% of my time to catch 20% of the cats instead of using the other way around. And it's very frustrating to the trapper, but it's a trapper sets for itself. Because you want to have all of this different diversity when you go out. And diversity is good as long as it keeps you in that high percentage. And there's, especially to a new trapper, if you go out and you set 15 different styles of bobcat sets, and you got two of each, and they're on different locations, there's no way to get a rhyme or reason of what's going on your line. There's just no way to do that. So, you know, you catch a few cats, you remember one that worked, you have no idea why, because there's no pattern there. Patterns are important when it comes to anything to do with nature, because natural systems in animals, you can pattern to a point. And if you stay inside that pattern, things work better. If you try to force something that's outside of that pattern, it normally doesn't work as well. So you got to stay inside that pattern that works. So when you're going out and you're trapping and you're looking at your line, or think back over your line last year, were you burning a lot of time on things that weren't that efficient as far as location sets and lure and bait combinations and different things like that? Because especially as a new trapper or someone that's even been in it for 5 or 6 years, every single magazine you come out has got somebody that's come up with the latest, greatest set. Every time you look at a form, someone does this and swears up and down that that's the best thing that you can do. You get on Facebook and you see 1,000 different ways to set a set for an animal. And then you start questioning what you know works, and you go out and you start looking at all these different things and you start playing around. Because I can tell you from personal experience, when I came back from Alaska and I was really wanting to get into coyote trapping, I was watching every DVD, going to all the demos. I had every single magazine. I bought dozens and dozens and dozens of books, of this, that, and the other. And you got big holes and little holes and step down holes and walkthrough type sets and trail sets, and some traps are up close, some are far back, some are blended, some have dirt, some are using peat moss, some are using buckwheat holes, all this type stuff. So when I went out and I would see like a field edge, I may put in a Charlie Robbins dirt hole set the way O'Gorman did it. And then there was a guy that just put in a article in a trapping magazine that, you know, he's watched how, he's got this really cool story about watching how mice had these little tunnels under grass, and some of them are facing each other, and you make the little line where it looks like the mouse trail between grass clumps, and you put your things there. I've done all that. I've done every bit of that. And you know what I learned during a lot of that? Nothing. Because I would have, if I was going to run at that time probably say 80, 90 sets, 70 of them would be different. So I couldn't see any type of pattern. And if you're going for pure enjoyment only, and you're truly not worried about what you're catching, that's totally fine. Because it is fun. Because, I mean, you're thinking about a coyote looking at it this way, and the mouse is going to run out that way, or the rabbit would do this, and you know, and you get really creative, and you're like a, you know, painting a Mona Lisa that down there at the dirt, and you get all excited about it, and this, that, and you go do it, repeat. But they're all different, and you can't learn anything. You can't see the patterns. Until you see these patterns, there's no way to figure out what you're wasting your time on and what you're productive with. And to take this to complete 180 degrees, if you're a single set guy and you do, like, say coons, for example, if you're a pocket set guy and you do nothing but pockets, you ignore the high bank trails, you ignore the water depth, you ignore the shape of the bank, because I've been there, I've done it. You force a pocket no matter what you see or where you're at or what the coons are showing you or what your catch is, because that's the best raccoon set. You don't know if you're having a good catch or a bad catch. Because I can tell you, when I went to Iowa, and especially after Red O'Hearn put his video out, which is a good video, everybody there did exactly what Red showed in the video. I don't know how they knew whose set was what under so many bridges. They had the same size hole that was used with Red's shovel. They were using Red's bait. They were using Red's trap with Red's modification with Red's drowning system. I mean, they were identical. And there was... had to been 1,000 people using that system, and over and over and over again, which to me was great, because I went out there with the same intention. But when you have to step over coon trails that's 10 foot up the bank from these pocket sets to go put the pocket sets in, eventually I started going, maybe I need to set these trails up because obviously the coon are right here. And then I started setting those up. But if you're year after year after year, even if you're catching a high number of coon in a place that's got a high coon population, how do you know if you're in on what side of the spectrum you are on the 80-20 rule? You don't know. And you may not care. I mean, that's an individual thing. But if you're trying to get in the most efficient way to set traps, you've got to set 80% of your system in place to catch majority of your fur. If you're using 20% of your sets to catch all of your fur, think of all that wasted space on that between 21% to 100% that you're not catching, but you're still acting and you're doing the work of the catching, if you follow what I'm saying there. And it's something that trappers, especially new trappers, and it can be frustrating because in the microwave society that we have now, somehow people think that a technique is a system. And it's not. You know, I'm still taking that permaculture design course. And I'm going to use an example of this. I'm not going to go into permaculture here because of the topic. But it really lit up like light bulbs to me why a lot of trappers have trouble with getting their catch above where it is now. Because the same thing happens to a gardener or a farmer or an orchardist or whatever. So I'm going to talk a little bit about gardening to show you an example, and then we're going to take it back to trapping because this is hugely important if you're worried about getting your catch up. So in gardening, I want you to sit back and close your eyes and think about, how do you best grow tomatoes and corn and squash and watermelon and whatever it is you grow, onions. I bet you're not thinking about the whole design of the garden, you're thinking about techniques of the garden, which is for somehow in the modern America, that's got confused with design. I'm hoping that, and don't start emailing me about this, I'm hoping that somehow down the road, as I get more and more understanding of design and not techniques, that there'd be a way to implement the design of permaculture, which is just a design science. It's not growing this or growing that. It's much bigger than that. It's the design. And figure out a way to have a trapper design course instead of a trapper technique course. Because around here, being out in rural Tennessee, what most people do, they think about a technique. You got people that do traditional style. Well, they take a rotor tiller and they till up their garden, and you know, and then they fluff it all out and they put their strings out and they put their everything's in nice neat rows, and then they put their fertilizer or their chicken manure or whatever they're going to do on there, and then they grow vegetables. That's a technique. That's not a design of something, because if you looked at it from a design point, that's pretty poor. Then you've got people that just do raised beds. Well, raised beds a technique. It's not a design system in and of itself. So you build your box, you put your dirt in there, and you plant your plants. It's a technique. You can do hugelkultur, which is burying large amounts of wood and putting dirt on top of it. It acts like a sponge with the water, and it's real fungal. Plants love it. It grows good. You hardly ever have to water your garden. That's a technique. It's not a design. Same thing with no-till lasagna gardens, which is a technique I use a lot, where I just keep adding organic material, let it break down, soil's real happy. That's a technique. Now, design in gardening, Well, you got to think about how the sun's going to come over it. How's it going to give you the most advantage? How can you have edges, which is the most prolific thing in nature? Think about your trapping. That's where most of your animals at. That's where most of the feed's at. That's where most of the nutrition's at. Everything is on the edges. So having a great big open garden may not be as good as having smaller gardens that have edges in there with bushes and trees and things like that, because you're designing the most important aspect of a garden into, or of nature into your garden. Now, what about water? If you have straight rows and there's any incline on your land, which there is, even if you think it's flat, water's going to run out one end or the other. Wouldn't it be important to have water in the garden? Well, if you plant on contour, which if you don't know what that is, Google it up, contour map, you'll see your rows won't be straight because they're going to be on contour. And if the water goes downhill, they go against the hill. So every time water falls, it soaks in and stays in there. That's a different technique, but it's part of design. And then are you going to have live mulches? Or are you going to have bare dirt? Or are you going to have dead mulches like hay or wood chips or whatever? That's a technique that could be designed to hold moisture. So with the permaculture thing, you just don't look at a plot of ground where you go till it up, put everything in straight rows, and pray for everything works out right. You design the garden using edges and water and the sun and living mulches and edges, and you design all this, and it doesn't look like a traditional garden in someone's backyard. But it functions better. Design. Now, when we're talking about the 80% rule for your trapping, the 20-80 rule, if you started looking at your trapping system in a designer's way of looking at it, it gets really, really interesting, and it gets really cool, and it gets really efficient. Because if you, what happens, I believe, with a lot of guys is they get so technique driven, and that's all they want is the technique. How do I do A? How do I do B? How do I do C? Well, A, B, and C are connected, I guarantee you, in more ways than you want to realize. And if you don't think about that or design that in your system, they don't flow, they don't work right, and they don't work together. So your system doesn't work right. So if you're a coyote trapper, just for an example, and you go pounding dirt hole after dirt hole after dirt hole at every single crossing or field edge or whatever it is you do, you're using techniques, but you're not being that efficient. And you're definitely not looking at it from a whole system way of going about it. Because if you start thinking about systems, you got to start taking into account weather, animal patterns, time of year, frozen ground, snow, thawed out ground, muddy ground, clay ground, sand ground. You got to have a system in place that you can handle all of those. You got to start thinking about if you're getting in the winter and you're getting frozen ground, which side of the field may be better or side of the hill may be better because of the way the soil stays frozen, which may be good for you, or thaws out, which may be good for you. Which way the air comes up and down elevation. All that, when you start looking at your trap line in that way, now you're thinking like a designer of a trap line. You're getting way outside the scope of a technique. How to bed a trap is a technique that can be part of a system that works better. How you dig a hole, whether it be with a little bitty trowel, a tile spade, or an auger, or a dog. I've seen guys use dogs to dig dirt holes. I think that's genius to do that. But all those are techniques on how to do a dirt hole, to do a set inside of a system of a trap line. And if you've never thought that way, and most people haven't, and not that I'm some extra smart, whatever, this, that, and the other, but things it amazes me how in our modern world we separate and departmentalize every single thing, and we don't let them touch. Well, that's okay, I guess, if you're doing accounting or you're doing something like that that's very specific there's no interaction between anything else going on. But when you get out in the woods and you're setting traps, you got a lot of stuff going on. And if you're just doing a technique over and over again, you're going to be into that. I'm doing 80% of the work for 20% of the catch. And the really good trappers, the ones that just seem to catch stuff no matter what, they may not have the words to put it in a design fashion, or they may not have the words to explain why they put it where it is and all this type of stuff. But if you really start following them, they've been at it long enough and open-minded enough to pay attention to what's going on around them. And no matter what situation they get into, they can adjust very quickly because their design of their trapping system is set up for that. Like one of the most amazing trappers that I've been with that at the time I didn't understand was Matt Jones. Matt Jones is a phenomenal trapper. He can look at something. He must have like a mega mass computer in his brain, and he can digest everything he's seeing, walk over somewhere, put a set in, and within 2 or 3 days, there's a coyote standing there. And I would ask him over and over again, we were going, why in the world did you set here? What's where the coyote's going to be? And most of the time, he was right. Very efficient. Even though he did different things, it was set up in a system where it allowed him to catch more stuff. And it's really hard to teach, and it's really hard to explain, and it's almost impossible to put in a print word like in an article. It's one of those things you've got to be there and think that way for it to start making sense. Because if you stay in the technique mind of everything, you're always hindering your progression. Because you think the dirt hole is the thing, and it's not. You think just the location is the thing, and it's not. Or just this bait or lure, and it's not. Or the way I stake it, or the way I bet it, or all those are just little techniques that kind of group together. And the problem, if you don't think about everything you're doing in a design fashion, kind of the way I did the portable pocket, and I've been looking at a different way to do that that's even more efficient to give me a better system to handle more environments. And I can do it so quick and so easy that it's scary. That is, that's what I personally I'm always striving for. And eventually you get to the point where you get super efficient and the system that you got in place and just the overall view of looking at everything. Now you're going into a trap line and you're thinking of everything in the designer's way of looking at it instead of a technician's way of looking at it. Because a technician, if something doesn't play out right, a technician can only go and do that technique again and hope it works better. Which is what a lot of guys do. And it's not just trapping, it's everything. It's finances, it's business, it's how you deal with people, it's everything. And if you start looking at design, you start seeing there's so many cool things you could try. And then if it's not in that efficiency zone, you kick them out and you try something else. But you keep your core to where you know it is. That's the reason my cat sets have not evolved much in about 6 or 7 years. Every time I try to get out of that zone, my catch goes down. Every single time. Even when I'm using a portable pocket with my system of bobcat trapping, like in the Cat Collector DVD, it's basically the same, except I'm using a portable pocket instead of a hole, and I'm using the stake most of the time instead of a drag, because it's all one integrated system. And I've designed that whole thing in to be like that. And it's just a totally different way to look at your trapping. But if you do, oh, dude, the universe opens up. And I don't even know how. I mean, it's taken me about 3 years to understand designing my yard for production. Until I took this course, which I would recommend someone take a permaculture design course like I'm doing online, But if you're not in the garden, you may get aggravated because you'd be focusing on the technique instead of the design part, and they're expensive. The design course I'm taking is close to $1,000. Best money I can think of spending. Because not only is it helped me understand where I can design my business, my life, my fun time, my trapping, my gardening, my trees, all that, I'm looking at everything I do now in a designer's look. How can I do the business to design the business to give me more freedom? Not just how can I put more hours or pump out more products. How can I set things up in the shop where it's more efficient to allow me to have more freedom to do other things that I want to do besides just make lure all the time? Designer's way of doing it. Same thing with something as simple as a house. If you really got into looking at things of a design, if your house is like mine and you start really thinking about things like that, you start getting pretty upset the way your house is set up. I mean, you really do. Just a simple design thing to look at a house different. If you were to build a house out of straw bale, you're never going to get insulation in a house with sticks to do the same thing. It's cheaper. It lasts longer. There's straw bale houses that's been all over Europe, and it's 600 years old. Ain't none of our houses going to be around here in 600 years. None. If you're up north and you're spending a lot of money on oil and gas, and you just do it because you think that there's no other option, and the technique is turning on that furnace, or praying the power don't go out on your pellet stove, or you're trying to use electricity or whatever you're using. If you think about it from a technique point of view, those are techniques, just like in trapping. But if you think about it from a designer's format, well, part of the problem is the way the houses are built. The other part is the heating systems are so inefficient. If you in Montana, where it's cold, I'm talking cold, there's people with a mass rocket heater that don't burn a cord of wood in a winter in Montana in a teepee with a mass rocket stove. A designer's going to look at that and go, why in the world am I doing this? I should be able to design the heat function into the house. We don't do that. We build the house and we put a heat source on it. Technique. It doesn't make any sense. Even if you don't have any intention whatsoever, and I don't know how well this would work in like around Cleveland, Ohio, or Seattle, because I feel sorry for you. I mean, a sunshiny day is like a very unique situation. Y'all live in the clouds. Or overcast. It's the dangest thing I've ever seen. It's got to be the Great Lakes. So this may not work for you. But from Kentucky, Southern Illinois down, every house, if you look at a house from a designer's point of view, could easily have a greenhouse on the southern side, even if you don't want to do plants. Follow me with it. This is the way a designer thinks. And I'm using examples outside of trapping to try to get you to think, because that's the way it works for me, and I'm hoping it's working for you. If you put a greenhouse on the southern side of your house, which is what I'll be doing this fall, our temperatures here will range between 0 degrees and 50 degrees probably all winter. So we're probably bouncing right around the freezing mark, 38 degrees, something like that in the wintertime, with a lot of sunny days and a lot of rainy days. But I mean, we still have quite a bit of sun. If I put a greenhouse, which I'm going to do on the southern side of my house, because I'm now looking at my heating, because I don't like spending money unless I have to. From a design point of view, if I put that greenhouse out there, the heat rises. Everybody knows that. Now here's where you can design into the greenhouse to make everything else more efficient. If you put a pipe, a black pipe, say a 12-inch pipe up there, and you put holes in it, and you put it at the very top where if you've got a crest on it or at the very top of a hoop house type thing, you put that pipe up there, the heat goes into that pipe. Now the heat's sitting in the pipe. Well, I'm not worried about heating the greenhouse because I'm not growing anything up at the ceiling. So how can I design that into how to work better? I can take a simple fan and run a pipe under my house because we're not on a slab per se. We don't have basement. I don't have a basement. It's just a crawl space. I can take that air that's 80, 90, and 100 degrees when it's 30 degrees outside. Heat rises. I can take that pipe, funnel it straight down, suck it through the pipe with a small squirrel fan that won't have any electricity use hardly whatsoever. And I can put 100 degree temperatures underneath the house, my house, which will heat me pretty much on sunny days free. That's designing. And when you're thinking about your trapping, if you start breaking down everything you're doing, thinking about it from a designer's point of view, things get really, really interesting. How do you deal with weather? What is your weather? What's it like during different parts of the year? How can you design your trap line into being a better form of that? You know, it a lot of times what people consider wasted energy or different things like that is not really wasted energy. Most of the time in permaculture, there's a saying, and if you put this to your trapping guys, I promise you, it'll elevate you to a different level. The problem is the solution. The problem is the solution. So if you're having a problem, it's also probably going to be a solution to something else. Or you can see a solution from it very quickly. But if you just see a problem, which is what most people see when something doesn't go wrong, they focus on the problem instead of sitting back and thinking about it from a designer's point of view. They focus on the problem and they make the wrong decisions because they make knee-jerk decisions not based off the total system. That's why I don't like using dirt around traps. From a designer's point of view, dirt and water makes mud. Cold makes ice. Muddy ice is not good for traps. So let's not use the muddy ice when we're bedding traps, because it's going to rain. It's going to get cold. It's going to soak up with water. Now, a really cool design technique is the wax dirt. If you can make enough of it and you don't go broke doing it and you can carry enough of it around, that's a really cool way someone thought about that from a design and get the water off of the set. From a designer's point of view, if you're looking at something through form of design and you put a shallow spot over your hole, you're designing in by that system. The trapper has designed in a mud puddle. Does that make any sense if you think about it in that stretch of the imagination? Now, I know at a demo in a floor that's half dirt and half horse crap and it's dry, that makes perfectly good sense. Move that system outside during the rain at a demo and watch it in 50 seconds. You'll see the problem really quick. The step down like that when you add water is a designer's flaw of the set. But most people just see it as a technique. Try to guide the foot, try to do this, whatever they're trying to do. But they hadn't looked at it from a designer's point. They hadn't put that technique in a complete circle of the system where they've got to look at all the aspects of that. Having lure, and see, there's been designing way to look at trappers for years. You look at a lot of the old books, especially the old Wolfer books, you'll find a lot of them that played around with a dirt hole that would be on a more steeple angle than what most of us would do today, and to try to get the lure odor out better, they would drive a rebar down in the back and try to do like a chimney type thing so it could draw air in. And the way that a lot of woofers set front and back and three traps around a set, they basically had two different points of interest, because I don't know how you would know which, because I haven't looked at that as far as design, which one of those is going to force the air out. Is the bigger hole going to force out the little holes, or the little hole going to help force out the big hole? I really don't know. But they could see the issue with a lot of lures and stuff being more stagnant, staying close to the ground and not pulling out. Well, like a portable pocket type idea, or an M44, a mock M44 style thing where it's like a grab and die stick type thing, that gets the lure and bait above the ground so it can go out further. And a lot of times you don't have the bacteria and the mold problems that you have when you have in the ground. So somebody was thinking about it from a designer's point of view. How do I design this set to do A, B, C, and D and still work and function the way that it's supposed to? Looking at things like a designer's guide, I mean, it is cool when you start thinking about that. You'll start thinking about your vehicle. You'll start thinking about the way you load it. You'll start thinking about the way you carry stuff, how you dig holes, how you do everything. But it's got to be from the designer's mind, not a technician's mind. Because a lot of you may not know this. Years ago, probably 20 years ago, I used to sell paintings at art shows. It's a natural, easy thing for me to do. I can paint very easily. People paid me money for it. And, you know, to me, it was pretty cool. I could sit in my living room, watch a History Channel back when it was more documentaries, and I could make $300-$400 a day painting. Basically, I go sell them on the weekends. It was a cool way to go. But I was not a technician because I don't know how to paint. But I could look and listen to the people that were coming in and seeing what they were interested in and what topics and this, that, and the other. And then I would come up with a way to give them what they wanted in the artwork. And I made pretty good money. Technicians that are technical painters, when it comes to, like, you see the books, if you ever go to you see an art book somewhere or at school or your art teacher, if you remember back to that, you have these, all these rules. You got to have light to dark. You got to have one side's darker than the other. It needs to be on an angle straight across. You never have anything that's even numbers. It's got to be odd. I can go on and on about the rules of art. They're all hogwash. And people that were technicians on the rules of art, very few of them made any money because their paintings were generic, dead, uninteresting, and it didn't turn people on, which is what art does. If someone's going to give you money, they're turned on by what you did and they want to see it all the time. Technicians couldn't figure out how to do that. They knew how to paint. They knew how to work a color wheel. I don't, never did, don't care to. But I didn't look at it from a technician's point of view because I wasn't one. And the same thing when I look at trapping now, I see guys that do techniques or they focus on techniques and not the total system and it gets screwed up. And when I have students that's come down and when I had time to do that and someone would ask about a location, every one of them would be almost completely different. But to me, it made perfect sense because I'm looking at it from a bigger point of view than just right here at the corner where this trail meets the road. How's the water going to come down the trail? How's the air going to hit the lure and where's it going to push it to? All that stuff had to be thought of very quickly. And after you do it a while, it just kind of makes sense. You see it and you do it. Your brain's an amazing computer when it comes to that. I'll be able to put stuff together, but you got to give it a chance to do that. So when students would come down and we would talk about a location, we could talk about a location for 30 minutes because when I'm talking to a student, I had to put it in words. When I'm looking at it quickly, all of a sudden now it's, you just see all this stuff and you adjust really quick and the systems that I was putting in would be best for whatever was going on then. That's what the reason I, you know, and I joke around and say that I've got a redneck holistic style of trapping or a holistic hippie style of trapping. It's because it's not technique. It's based off observation. And I didn't know it at the time, but I was looking at my trap line in more of a design type feature. And when you go out and you do that, your catch goes up because you start looking at all this different aspects that actually affect, because when you have a technique or you departmentalize a set or technique, and you put in a, I'm going to say a flat set because I don't want anybody to think I'm picking on dirt holes. You put in a flat set, and the way most trappers look at that set, they could take a ruler around there, like, you know, 2 feet or 6 inches away from the dirt and the hole, and then that's the only world that they're thinking about is that right there. Because they're not thinking about the wind, the water, the sun, the freezing ground, the animal patterns, the time of year, all that other stuff that affects that little box that they just did the technique on. So the little box is pretty much sticking out there by itself, and it doesn't function correctly a lot of times because it's separate from the systems that's around it, which is the animals and the wind and the water and all that stuff is coming to play with that. And then you go out with them after a big rain and 99% of all their sets are washed out for days because the technique was that particular style of flat set without thinking at it from a designer's point of view. Well, I can't believe I talked about that, but I mean, this is the stuff, guys, that turns me on. I'm sorry if you're looking for a technique. That's why it's so hard when someone calls up and goes, how do I catch a coyote? Well, that'd be the same as, well, how does GM build a Corvette? It'd be like asking the designer of the Corvette how to do that. And if you think that building the Corvette is more complicated than trapping, you're fooling yourself. The problem is, we just don't look at it that way. Because you can do some really crude stuff completely out of context with the environment. And you will catch some stuff. And it gives you a false sense of security about what you're doing. And then before you know it, you're thinking that's the way to go. Because you're not looking at everything together. So when you're going out and you're thinking about your trap line, there's two things that I really wish that I could pound in your head for next year. The 20-80 rule, because 20% of whatever you're doing is catching 80% of your fur, and you need to concentrate on it, period. When you start getting out of those numbers, you need to start sucking back into that 20% or you're going to be inefficient, unless you're doing it for different reasons besides just catch, numbers, and money. The other thing is, don't get so hooked on techniques. About everything you see in a trapping magazine is a technique. It's isolated and it's not hooked to anything around it. Don't get so focused. Don't make them pets. You know, don't keep them like student loans. They're not your friends because there's a bigger world outside of that 2 foot box that you're going to put them in when you go out there to do it. And think about different things in your life as far as design. Besides just your trapping, because there's more to life than trapping, believe it or not. And if you start looking at things through the eyes of a designer, now you start getting, life just gets more interesting. Because now you can start doing stuff that you don't do. You know, it's amazing to me. And I'm just to finish on the departmentalized. It's interesting to me that a technique of retirement is outsourcing your money to people that you don't know that has their best interest at heart and not yours. And you wonder why at the end of the road, it's not what you thought it would be because the people that you outsourced your retirement to did exactly what they're going to do, which is take care of themselves and not you. Just like stock market. People do that every day. The technique is a 401k. The technique is a Roth IRA or a pension plan or something like that. That's not designing someone's retirement. Same thing with a house. You buy a house, and to me, if America ever wants to get back on track, or if you ever want to figure out how to really get ahead in life, I'll give you one really mind-blowing thing if you'll take it to heart. The biggest investment most Americans make is their house. Hands down. Some people it's student loans, but some people it's their house. Most people it's their house. through marketing and not looking at your finances through a design, you do really stupid stuff your whole life and you wonder why you end up broke. Starter houses is a marketing platform to sell houses. Now, your grandparents that grew up in the same house for 50, 60 years, they didn't have all the expense of a modern person now because they're moving like on, I think it's an average of every 4 years. They didn't have the moving expenses. They didn't have the closing cost expenses. They didn't have the inflation on the new money that's going towards the new product that's going to be out of whack here in a little bit anyway because of deflation of the dollar. They didn't have to deal with all that. They bought a house. They stayed in it. They did something with it. And back even before your grandparents, a house, as simple as a house seems, a designer is going to look at that house and go, okay, in the world we live in, how in the world am I going to spend, say, $150,000 on this house? I'm going to pay it off in 30 years, so it's actually going to cost me probably somewhere around $300,000, and then I'm going to throw in all the taxes, this, that, and the other, and it's going to be about $400,000. And then I'm going to sell it for $200,000 and I'm going to let somebody be so clever in the way they use the words that I made money on the house even though I lost $200,000. And the reason most people lose money on the house because the real cost of that house over that time is they don't do anything productive with the house. If you have a house and you're invested $150,000 in something, from a designer's point of view, if you start looking at it this way, guys, what is that house doing for you? How is that house making you money? How is it gaining in value, not just in the devaluation of the dollar? Because that's not really gaining you money. How can you make your house productive for the biggest investment of your life? And you pay it off, you lose money on it, and you wonder why you get it so upside down later in life. From a designer's point of view, I'm not going to tell you what you should do because I don't know what you should do. That's the reason I personally believe that everybody ought to run a home business. That's one of the easiest and quickest ways that your house, your biggest investment, you can design into your biggest investment a way for it to pay for itself or pay for most of it. I mean, you got to have somewhere to live. So if it doesn't pay for all of it, it can pay for some of it. And to have a business that pays for your house. I mean, think how radical that is. Most people will not do anything with their house or their land, no matter how small, big, grand, or old-fashioned it is, to let the investment actually do something for them. How crazy is that? That's what departmentalizing everything is. My house has always made me money. Always. It's an investment. It's supposed to make me money. That's what an investment's supposed to do. If your house payments are $1,000 a year and you got 12 months in a year and you got $12,000, at minimum, guys, design something in your life through that house, that yard, the shop, the whatever, that you can get $12,000 back out of that and at least pay for itself. And hopefully do a little bit more so now it's your house is making you money. Someone that departmentalizes just like in trapping, just like in their house, they wonder why they're always swimming upstream. Because they don't design anything. They just outsource everything. That's what a designer, that's the way it'd be. If trappers wanted to be really cool, just like I was talking last week about if we were to design a system to buy, sell directly to the end market of the fur users, everybody's better off. Designing something like that is designing it where it's in everybody's favor and everybody does better and everybody's happier. The bad weeds get culled out. The good trappers with the good fur make more money. And everybody goes about their business and everybody, that's designing in an industry that does not want to design anything because they don't think past any boxes that they got. Everything You know, you got traps in the box, you got your sets in the box, you got your locations in a box, you got your trap lines in a box, you got your fur handling in a box, you've got your selling fur in a box, you got what you do with that money in a box, and very few of those boxes are connected. Well, when you design, it's just one big box. And that box can make everything easier and more efficient and more profitable, or it could be time saving, energy saving, more time with your kids out on the trap line, whatever. So whatever it is you want to do, think about your trapping in the 20/80 rule and think about how to start thinking about it from a designer's point of view and not as a technician's point of view. And when you do that, you're going to be a better trapper. So this week, I want you to go out there and just look around your trap shed. Something simple as your trap shed. How can I design the trap shed to make my life easier and get more production out of it? How can you do that? It could be something as simple as it needs more lights. Maybe the way the tables are set up so it flows better. I don't know. If that's important to you on your trapping to be more efficient, start designing that. Start designing how your truck's going to be, designing how your building's going to be, how you're going to get stuff there, how you're going to make the set, how design better ways to put up the fur, design better ways to sell the fur, design better ways to learn about catching more fur. It's all out there. All you got to do is think about it from a non-technical point of view, but from a designer's point of view, and life just gets more interesting.